calling Vladimir Putin today, Thursday, April 17th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Russia's President Putin uses his annual phone-in TV show to stand firm on Ukraine and to answer questions from citizens.
He picked one from a six-year-old girl who asked, if Putin was drowning, would Obama save him?
Also, evidence that those pro-Russia militias in Ukraine may not be local. This correspondent asked one group to name the village they were in.
They were at a loss. They didn't know the name of the village.
Plus, why some Sudanese women in California follow a tradition from back home that involves bathing their skin in wood smoke.
It's relaxing. I like the smell. I like the skin color it gives me. I become orange. That may sound weird, but it looks really nice.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-Mile Run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Vladimir Putin seemed to have an answer today to all those in the West warning Russia to stay out of Ukraine. The Russian president said his nation has the right to send troops into Ukraine to protect ethnic Russians. He made that comment on a day when three pro-Russia protesters were reportedly killed in eastern Ukraine in a clash with Ukrainian military forces. Clearly, events on the ground today overshadowed high-level talks in Geneva aimed at finding a solution to the crisis. The BBC's David Stern is in Donetsk. So what's the latest today, David? What have you seen?
Well, there's been obviously a lot going on, as there has been every day recently in Ukraine. Overnight, we had clashes between government forces and pro-Russian activists. As usual, it's difficult to say what exactly happened, but there are confirmed three deaths on the activist side. The government forces say that they were attacked. Of course, the activists say it was the other way around. And there were 13 injuries, according to the government. This happened in Mariupol, and the incident took place at a National Guard base.
Well, is this the first time violence has taken place there in this crisis? I mean, is there a sense that violence is spreading?
Well, no. It's still isolated. This is the first time that there's been violence in Mariupol, as far as I remember, although the activists have taken over a government building there and barricaded themselves in there. We've had a number of incidents where there have been clashes or shots fired in the air, but so far it hasn't exploded thankfully, it hasn't exploded into something much larger. But the risk is always there.
Now, you and I spoke yesterday about Ukrainian armored personnel carriers being overtaken by pro-Russian activists, but some more details emerged today about what went down with one of these APC incidents, and it wasn't exactly the Ukrainian military's finest hour. These APCs were basically surrounded, if I get this correctly, by old babushkas with their like kerchiefs on and these famous non-insignia troops. Is that correct?
Yes. Well, I was not there. I've been speaking to other correspondents, including BBC correspondents who were there. They are surrounded by everybody, not just babushkas and civilians, but there's all types. And as far as I understand, there were some very serious gunmen that showed up. And, you know, again, nobody knows, nobody's able to check the identity of these people. Mm. Obviously, you can't walk up to them and say, show me your passport. But one BBC correspondent walked up to two people who were outside next to some APCs and said, excuse me, what's the name of this village? And they were at a loss. They didn't know the name of the village.
Wow.
So it's, yeah. So it indicates, and now this doesn't mean that these are necessarily Russian, as they're referred to, you know, as tourists. They could be from another part of Ukraine, but it does show that there are strong indications that there are people from elsewhere taking part in this.
Now, President Putin kind of dramatically stated that Ukraine is on the edge of an abyss. Is that rhetoric, do you think, or do you feel there on the ground that you're kind of staring into a void?
Some moments, yes. Some moments, no. There's been obviously there've been flare-ups, and we think that now it's all going to happen, and then the tension manages to dial back. There's also a false feeling that if it's been quiet for the last 5 hours, then the story is going flat, or that nothing's going to happen. But that's just from the journalist's point of view, it's important, and I try to keep in mind at all times that this could explode at any moment. It has been an extremely unpredictable story. Now, the sense of being on the edge of the abyss also is, I guess the part of it is the fact that we don't know what the various players want. Russia could be saying, they could be being absolutely truthful when they say they have no designs on Eastern Europe, and in fact their people aren't here. Let's say it's a possibility. But the other possibility is also very true. And as I said before, there's a lot of evidence, anecdotal and otherwise, to prove that there is some sort of Russian involvement. And if there is Russian involvement, then ultimately the question is, what does Russia ultimately want? And nobody knows the answer to that question.
The BBC's David Stern in Donetsk. Always great to speak with you, David. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Marco.
Well, if anyone knows what Russia wants, it's Russian President Vladimir Putin. The crisis in Ukraine didn't prevent him today from holding his annual live phone-in show where he answers questions from citizens. As usual, it was broadcast on Russian television. Correspondent Charles Maines in Moscow listened in and says Putin gave a vigorous defense of Russia's role in Ukraine.
You get the sense that Russia is the only sort of rational actor in all this. I mean, everyone else, America, Europe, are giving in to emotions. But the key points were that he was saying that essentially he had the authority to protect Russians in East Ukraine, including using the military, but he hoped that diplomacy would prevail. He also mentioned that these military maneuvers by the Ukrainian army were illegal and from his point of view, that these were a sort of a crime against the people of East Ukraine.
Mm. By the way, what does this live Putin call-in show actually look like? Is he on a set walking around with a microphone like Phil Donahue, or is he seated? What's the deal?
Yeah, it has a little bit of that feel to it. I mean, essentially, it's Putin behind a desk. There are two correspondents and a small audience, including some well-known Russians. For example, Ramzan Kadyrov, the head of Chechnya, was there. Some other governors, some of the Ukrainian Berkut secret services were there. So you have this kind of representation of different aspects of the Russian population. But then they do this kind of high-tech performance where they kind of beam into small villages and cities. And for example, this time it was quite noteworthy that they went straight to Crimea for the first questions. Mm. But it does have a little bit, there are moments where it can veer into kind of like a late night show. I mean, it's a 4-hour marathon. So, by the end, Putin was just taking his own questions. It felt a little bit like David Letterman or something. He's sort of reading his own questions and giving answers to them like a list.
I don't know how many one-liners there were, but there was a memorable moment when former U.S. intelligence agent Edward Snowden popped up via a video link. Let's listen to this.
Does Russia intercept, store, or analyze in any way the communications of millions of individuals? And do you believe that simply increasing the effectiveness of intelligence or law enforcement investigations can justify placing societies rather than subjects under surveillance? Thank you.
Edward Snowden wanted to know, does Russia store and analyze information like the NSA? So Putin's a former KGB agent, found that amusing. How did he answer?
Well, that's right. He said, well, both of us as sort of former guys in the Secret Services, we can speak on this professionally. But his answer essentially was that Russia didn't have the technical capability that the Americans had, that Russian Secret Services had always acted in accordance with courts and the law. And if they did tap into, doing some surveillance of any kind, it was for national security and to fight terrorism, things like that. This comes across as a bit disingenuous because there's quite a lot of evidence, in fact, that the Russians have basically the equivalent of the PRISM surveillance system, and theirs is called SORM. It was interesting because the timing of this, Pavel Durov, who's the founder of the company Vkontakte, it's essentially the Russian Facebook, so you might think of him as kind of the Russian Mark Zuckerberg. He went public, in fact, with demands from the secret services in Russia to provide data on the Maidan protesters in Ukraine, as well as Russian opposition figures. In fact, he'd been forced to give up his shares in the company because of it.
Charles, how much of this whole call-in show idea is just scripted?
It's sort of this lingering question to the whole thing. Is it real or is it theater? And I guess my take on it is that it's theater, but it's instructive theater. It's a pretty good performance by Putin. He's very commanding with statistics. He seems to know everything. And while there are a lot of softball questions and praising of the Russian leader, they do enter into these sort of uncomfortable issues as well. But, the caveat here is that Putin seems to know all the answers and he doesn't have to take any follow-up questions. So he seems to kind of bat these things around very easily.
I can't let you go without talking about one telephone call from a girl who's 6 years old. And maybe this will shed a little light on U.S.-Russia relations.
Well, this was, again, towards the end of Putin's performance. He was taking – these are questions that he picked himself, and he picked one from a six-year-old girl who asked that, sort of a hypothetical question, if Putin was drowning, would Obama save him? This got a big laugh from the crowd, and essentially said that, ultimately he thought that Obama was a decent guy and would probably lend a hand.
Okay. Correspondent Charles Maines in Moscow, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
Well, one place where Putin is apparently lending a hand is in Syria. Russia is providing arms to help the government of Bashar al-Assad defeat the Syrian rebels. The rebels have long been outgunned by Syrian forces, but recently Syrian rebels have gotten their hands on a new type of weapon. What's interesting is where it's from. The World's Matthew Bell reports.
The weapon we're talking about here is the BGM-71 TOW anti-tank missile. It's from the 1970s. But on the battlefield in Syria, it can give rebel fighters an edge against Syrian government forces. This video is said to be from a relatively new faction of the Free Syrian Army, and the men in it are shown launching a TOW missile at what they describe as a government checkpoint. When experts saw this footage, along with some other recent videos, they took notice.
It's a big deal in that it's not just that there are weapons going into Syria, there are American-made weapons.
Andrew Tabler is with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy.
Now, that doesn't necessarily mean the United States is directly providing them. These weapons are in the inventories of our allies, Turkey and Saudi Arabia.
Tabler says it's probably safe to assume that's where they're coming from. Both Turkey and Saudi Arabia want to see the end of the Assad regime, and they have been providing weapons to Syrian rebel groups.
I think we can also assume to a large degree that this is done with the knowledge of the American government. And this would be in keeping with recent discussions about an uptick in support to the Syrian rebels.
Administration officials are not commenting on this, but Frederick Hoff of the Atlantic Council says the appearance of American anti-tank missiles in Syria signals a shift for the Obama administration. Hoff was U.S. Special Envoy for Syria in 2012.
It's a belated acknowledgement on the part of the United States that what's left of the nationalist armed opposition inside Syria really needs some assistance.
In other words, the so-called moderate opposition forces in Syria have their backs against the wall, and the White House might be trying to throw them a lifeline.
The weaponry itself is reasonably effective, not only against tanks, but against other fixed targets. And it appears that the United States at long last is moving into a position of really influencing, if not directing, who gets what inside Syria in terms of arms and equipment for the armed opposition.
The Obama administration has been wary about providing weapons to Syrian rebels, only to see them fall into the hands of extremist groups. Some opposition forces in Syria are linked with al-Qaeda. But the two rebel groups thought to have American-made missiles are different, says Charles Lister of the Brookings Institution in Doha.
Both of these organizations are comparatively new, but the most important aspect for both of them is that they are most certainly core Free Syrian Army, inherently moderate rebel organizations. So in that sense, again, it represents this new development represents the provision of weapons to really genuinely moderate rebels.
It's thought that rebel forces now have about 24 of the American-made rockets, which can be used against tanks, vehicles, or buildings. Lister says they could make a big difference in local battles, but they're not likely to turn the tide against Syrian government forces.
In terms of placing the entire conflict all together into one, I'm skeptical it will necessarily represent a game changer. I think really anti-aircraft weapons would really, in my view, be the only weapon system that could potentially represent a real game changer.
No one seems to think that's in the works. Experts say the Obama administration might be looking at this first batch of anti-tank missiles as a test case, watch to see how they're used and who's using them, and then think about what comes next. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
Still ahead, you can eat a Big Mac in Jerusalem on Passover, including the bun, but it still ain't gonna have cheese. On The World from PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-Mile Run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. I've had the privilege of seeing an eagle in the wild, but I've never seen an eagle hunt. Guess he can't have everything. But Asher Svidensky has witnessed that. He's a young photographer and travel writer who recently spent some time in Mongolia, and he came across a girl who hunts using an eagle. And that's the other odd part of the story. Svidensky says she might be the only female eagle huntress in Mongolia. Asher Svidensky joins us now from his home in Israel. So tell us about this girl. Her name is Ashel Pan. She lives in Mongolia. How'd she get into this rare form of eagle hunting?
This is an old tradition of Kazakhs that's called eagle hunting. It's old tradition that maintains trained eagles to hunt foxes, marmots, and small wolves. The difference between the hunters, Kazakh eagle hunters that live in Mongolia right now, to other places such as Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan, is that the hunters in Kazakhstan are practicing this tradition purely for tourism, while in Mongolia, the hunters live out of their prey. There is the real eagle hunters and the real fantasy living itself.
And why do you call it fantasy living?
Because every time I was there, it was seeing it felt unreal. You have this hunter who simply has an amazing weapon, which is the eagle, and they go on top of those snowy mountains. And every time, especially as a photographer, when you see it, you just feel like you're in a story, in a legend.
Mm. How does the process of hunting with an eagle actually work? I mean, especially the training. What exactly happens, and how is it different from hunting with falcons?
The main difference between falcon hunting and eagle hunting is the sheer power of the eagle. The eagle is a lot more powerful and has a lot more potential to hunt. They say there's about 1,500 ways to train and hunt with an eagle. Every family develops its own way of practicing it. The system of that is actually pretty simple. One hunter goes on top of the mountain or tall rock, and the other one scares the animal down and below it, throwing rocks, making noises. And the second, any animal, for example, a fox, runs away from the noise the eagle simply recognizes it and dive right after it.
As to the gender of this huntress you saw, I mean, it's usually men who do eagle hunting in Mongolia?
Yeah, tradition-wise, it's men. It's a men hobby. The thing is, when I was working on my project, I had in mind not to search for the eagle huntress, but to deal with the future generation of eagle hunters in Mongolia.
Right, and you're concerned that eagle hunting might just disappear?
It is a possibility. For me, the scariest thing is not to have it disappeared, but to have it become completely made for tourists. You know, for a very old tradition to become more of a museum and not a living, breathing tradition as it is now in Mongolia.
Would it help or hinder the tradition, the fact that Ashel Pan is a young woman?
In Mongolia, I've never seen a very strong chauvinist way of thinking. So her father is actually kind of pleased seeing his daughter doing it. So time will tell. And it's very interesting to see what will happen with that in the next 10 years.
Well, you certainly stumbled across a great story of this girl eagle huntress, photographer and travel writer Asher Svidensky. Thanks very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
When you're far from home, you long for things that remind you of where you came from, like the smell of your old house or the food you ate as a child. That's a theme we're going to be exploring on the show. Today, reporter Hannah Baba tells us about a traditional ritual from Sudan and how some Sudanese women are keeping it alive in Northern California. We've changed the names of some of the people in the story to protect their privacy.
It's a sunny afternoon in the Bay Area, perfect for a barbecue of sorts. Yasmini Mom is stoking some coals on her kitchen stove.
So this is just regular charcoal?
Just regular charcoal, yes. This might take 10 to 15 minutes.
Imam then takes the glowing coals to her back porch and puts them in an empty flower pot. She covers the coals with aromatic acacia and sandalwood. Then she disrobes, sits on some piled up bricks, and uses a blanket to create a small tent. The sweet smoke billows around her body.
It's relaxing. I like the smell. I like the skin color it gives me. I become orange. That may sound weird, but it looks really nice, kind of like this. People here do it tan, like they call it tan, right? So for us, Dukhan does the same thing as tan.
This tan is the tinting effect that acacia wood has when it's burned, and it's all part of a private beauty ritual called Dukhan. If you're from Sudan, you know it well. It's something many married women do at least weekly, and it's a long tradition in Imam's family.
It reminds me of my mom, my aunties, my grandma in Sudan. Just, whenever I do Dukhan, it pulls me back all these memories. It's a warm feelings, you know. It's not the smell itself, but the feelings that the smells give you.
But Sudanese women say it's tough to keep up the tradition in the U.S. Back home, the setup involves burying a clay pot in a yard. But here, many Sudanese live in apartments without yards. So they'll improvise and burn the wood in paint cans while sitting on the toilet or over a pot in the kitchen. Smoke detectors are covered up with aluminum foil to keep the alarm from going off. There are stories about neighbors calling the fire department because they smelled smoke. And then there's the fact that Dukhan leaves you with a heavy, woody scent that lingers for days. Imam tells me about the time she was at the mall after doing Dukhan. A store she was in suddenly went into lockdown. A clerk smelled smoke.
So I hesitated. Should I tell her or I shouldn't? Because I saw the firemen inside the store. So I give her my hand. I said, can you smell my hand? That the smell? That's the smell? She said, yes, oh my God, this is what I smell. What is this?
Imam tried to explain why she smelled like burning wood, but the woman at the store didn't get it. She said,
what is that? Are you doing like black magic or what? How can you sit on fire? So I had to apologize and leave the store.
And some Sudanese immigrants say the beauty ritual just isn't practical here. I met Jamila Abdel Halim, a lawyer. She was having tea at a friend's house.
It's just that the smell, because I work, it's not intuitive for the job environment.
Another woman, Manal Abdurrahman, says she enjoys Dukhan only in Sudan.
In this country, I like to be like Americanized. When I go back home, I do it on a regular basis.
None of that is enough to convince a grandmother who's visiting from Sudan. She scolds the women, saying there's no excuse for not making Dukhan a priority. She says no matter where she's lived, she's never skipped her Dukhan. She implores the women to hold on to their heritage. Back at Yasmin Imam's house, I help her adjust her blanket while she sits broiling on her DIY Dukhan pit.
Yeah, oh my God, I love these feelings.
Under your chin.
Yeah, right, that's it.
It's been 30 minutes. Dripping with sweat, she sticks her foot out of her cover and shows me her heel. It's now golden orange, tinted by the acacia wood smoke. This, she says, is what it's all about.
I'm not missing out, first of all. I can tell my family I did Dukhan. They cannot like tease me. Oh, we did Dukhan. That's what they used to do a long time. Oh, we did Dukhan. We can do Dukhan too. We can bring Sudan here.
For the world, I'm Hanat Baba, San Francisco.
You can bathe in smoke. I've seen it. You can too. We've got photos at PRI.org. And if you're an immigrant and there's something you do that reminds you of home, tell us on Twitter using the hashtag JustLikeHome. News headlines are coming up next. This is The World from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Tom of Finland will soon be honored with a new set of stamps. We remember how he became a gay icon.
We were very limited in our imagery before Tom of Finland. We were depicted as sissies or poofs or pansies or fairies, feminized, made lesser than. Tom sort of turned it around and made us more than.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-Mile Run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. The Arab Spring brought change to many Arab countries. Algeria was not one of them. The North African country was already and still is a democracy, on paper at least. There is an elected president and a national assembly. Elections are held at regular intervals. In fact, today is election day in Algeria, but you'd hardly know it there. While the cafes in the capital, Algiers, are brimming with people, the polling booths are relatively empty. As Asia Bundawi reports, many Algerian voters are feeling apathetic.
If you ask most Algerians on the street today, cab drivers, shopkeepers, retirees, students, why they're not voting, you'll get the same answer. I'm not going to vote, he says, because it's all a game, and the people have no choice in it. Just about everyone here expects that the current president, Abdelaziz Bouteflika, will run roughshod over his challengers. The 77-year-old was first elected in 1999. About 10 years later, he scrapped constitutional term limits so he could run for a third, and now a fourth, five-year term. But that's not why people are angry now. Bouteflika suffered a stroke last April, and that's left him visibly incapacitated. He's rarely appeared in public since. But this morning, with cameras snapping, the president was wheeled into a voting booth to cast his ballot. The image evoked the movie Weekend at Bernie's, where a dead boss is propped up and paraded around by his handlers.
You can have a comedy of democracy, but people know that it is comedy. It is not really a democracy.
Mustafa Benfoudel is a poet, playwright, and award-winning writer in Algeria. While many Algerians acknowledge Bouteflika brought peace and stability to Algeria after a bloody civil war with Islamist militants in the 90s, they say that Bouteflika is gone. In his place is a group of unknown men running things behind the scenes. And this sense of omnipotent rule is embodied in the term Algerians use to refer to the regime, the pouvoir, or the power.
We feel that there is a very big gap in the society between the political system and people. The word barakat now is, everybody repeats it.
Barakat, Arabic for enough, is a new movement to boycott the elections. Benfoudel is an active member. At a peaceful sit-in in the heart of Algiers yesterday, police cracked down hard on Barakat protesters, arresting and later releasing dozens. Mustafa was one of many activists beaten up by police during the protest. Amna Gulili is from Human Rights Watch.
They have been subjected to very harsh attacks from government, portraying them as trying to destabilize Algeria, that they are receiving orders from Western countries, etc. And the reason behind this kind of tactics is to send a message to the overall population.
The government's tactics seem to have worked. Barakat has remained a small-scale protest movement, and likely will, at least in the short term. Most people in Algeria these days seem skeptical of the system itself. They don't trust the regime or the opposition.
There are actually two confronting views in Algeria when it comes to the kind of change that the country may experience.
Emel Boubacour is a North African political analyst.
First, some people say, leave us alone, we are okay, I mean, we are fine. The regime will gradually change from the inside and we will adapt. But there is also young people who are saying, okay, I do not have a job, I'm unemployed. I need for the regime to hear my demands and to stop continuing to rule as if we do not exist.
The irony is that if those young Algerians did turn out en masse to vote, they could likely change the status quo. Without an Arab Spring or bloodshed or civil war, just an exercise in democracy. The 2012 parliamentary elections are a testament to that. The National Democratic Institute, an American NGO that monitors elections around the world, said that while there were irregularities, they saw no evidence of flagrant fraud. But the results of today's elections are a foregone conclusion to most in the country. Bouteflika will likely win a fourth term. But writer Mustafa Benfoudel says he's hopeful that the win of a clearly incapacitated president may spur his fellow Algerians onto some sort of political action.
I think that we are living a fantastic moment, even if it is hard, even if it is complicated. But I guess that after this period, we will see maybe a new kind of citizens.
For the World, I'm Asya Bundawi in Algiers.
Bad weather today hampered the search for survivors of that sunken South Korean ferry. Some 280 passengers are still unaccounted for and feared drowned, most of them high school students. Earlier, I spoke with South Korean reporter Jun Chang, who's in the city where the students came from.
Okay, right now I am in Ansan. This is where the students aboard the ferry, they are students at Tanwon High School. There are students ranging from 9th grade to 12th grade, all praying for their fellow students. Right now there's a candlelight vigil going on. All the students have pieces of paper with messages scribbled on them saying, stay strong, come back home safely, aren't you hungry, come back so we can have a meal together. The Korean Red Cross has been super supportive. They've been providing food, blankets, even providing counseling for those who need it.
Let's go to what's happening right now with the rescue operation. What is the theory about why this ferry sank in the first place? I gather the captain has actually been questioned by police now.
Okay, the ship is now stuck 32 meters below the water surface off of Byeongpung Island. So they were well on their way. The journey from Incheon to Jeju is about 13 and a half hours. Unfortunately, there was a dense fog, which caused a two-hour delay for the trip. Unfortunately, because there was a delay, people are speculating that the captain decided to take a shortcut for the journey. So this is possibly why the ship might have hit an underwater rock or a reef, which could explain why people felt an impact, a jolt, and they could hear a loud bang. So at that moment, people were saying that, oh, what should we do? Some people were just trying to follow orders because the broadcast was mentioning numerous times to stay put. The crew themselves, according to one of the local stations here, the captain told the crew to evacuate, so they just followed the captain's orders without saving anyone. So apparently that's their excuse. As to whether it's true or not, I'm not sure, but that's what's been going around. For instance, the lifeboats for this ferry, they were not released. They didn't deploy any of them, which is why there's a swirl of controversy going around at the moment.
So right now with this search and rescue mission, is there some way that maybe people who are still trapped below deck have some chance to find their way out to a place that's above water?
Okay, so the rescue teams have been trying to pump oxygen into the vessel for any air pockets if there are survivors. Right now, the water overnight temperatures are going down to 11 degrees Celsius, so hypothermia will be setting in for those who are still in the water, and the water is quite murky, so divers are having trouble entering the ship. As for any survivors, we're still hoping that there are survivors.
Apparently, South Korean President Park met with families of those missing. What was the mood at that meeting?
Well, President Park went to Jindo. That's where the parents are waiting. A lot of the family members are in Jindo, which is closest to the site. She has been trying to console them. It's unfortunate that the students were about to embark on a four-day trip to Jeju Island. It was something that they were looking forward to. So right now, everyone's in shock and disbelief. We're all on the edge of our seats trying to find any news of any survivors.
Reporter Jun Chang speaking to me from Ansan, South Korea. One of the more haunting parts of this ferry disaster is the dramatic bursts of communication between passengers on the boat and their loved ones on shore. A student texted his mother in Korean, "Mom, this might be the last chance to tell you I love you." His mother texted back, "Why's that?" And then, "I love you anyway." That young man was one of the lucky who was rescued. Then there's this text sent by another student to her father as the ferry was listing further and further into the water. We voiced a translation of the exchange.
"Dad, don't worry. I'm wearing a life vest and I'm with other girls. We're inside the ship, still in the hallway.
I know that the rescue is underway, but shouldn't you be waiting outside the rail? Try to get out if you can."
"The ship is too tilted. The hallway is crowded with so many people."
The young woman who texted that has yet to be located. For Jews who observe the week-long Passover holiday, this week can be hard on the palate. bread, leavened products, yeast products, they're all forbidden foods on the holiday. As the biblical Exodus story goes, the Israelites were in such a hurry to leave Egypt, they couldn't wait for their bread to rise. So the devout put themselves in the Israelites' shoes for Passover. In Jerusalem, those who crave bread this time of year are either out of luck, or they have to get very creative to get their fix. Some restaurants in the city offer up their own alternative, imitation bread products, for their Passover observant customers. Daniel Estrin took a little taste test in Jerusalem.
Walk into an eatery in Jerusalem this week, and at first glance, you might almost forget that it's Passover. Restaurants serve rolls, sandwich places serve sandwiches. I even stumbled onto one place that serves pizza, and it's all kosher for Passover. The secret ingredient in the pizza? Potato starch.
It's like a really deep dish pizza. You can kind of taste the potato in the potato starch, but it's a mushroom, cheese, olive, tomato sauce pizza. Not bad. This is surprising.
Surprising because imitation pizza, by definition, should not taste good. Pizza is pizza. Same goes for imitation crepes. The ice cream parlor across the street was serving French crepes that were kosher for Passover, or Pesach in Hebrew. They were made of potato starch and eggs, instead of the usual flour batter.
It's better than the crepe that we have usual.
Really?
Really.
Why?
I wait for this the whole year. It's harder to make because it's thick, but it's the best thing. It tastes better. I don't know, but maybe because of the potato powder.
Wow, that's different. It's good.
It's good, right?
Yeah.
I love it.
Now, at first sight, these faux foods do not look appetizing. One shawarma joint downtown serves their meat in pita wraps made of soy and cornstarch. I did not like it, but the place was packed with hungry customers. I asked the owner, Eli Azulai.
But doesn't it sort of defeat the purpose of Passover if you're not supposed to feel like you're eating bread and you're eating something that's like bread?
There is something. You're right, but, you know, in Pesach you want to eat. You more want to eat than every time in the whole year.
You crave bread more this week than any other time.
Yeah.
Plus, for Jewish tourists who observe the holiday, this growing trend of fake bread is especially exciting. Where else in the world can you find a McDonald's that serves kosher hamburgers on a potato starch bun for Passover? That's where I met Daniel and his wife and kids eating burgers at McDonald's in downtown Jerusalem. They're visiting from the Upper West Side of Manhattan.
The bun leaves a little bit to be desired, the bun, but the beef burger is very good.
Mom and the kids ate the burgers and only nibbled at the buns, but they were still satisfied customers.
It's a little heavy. It's a little dry. I think that's a good term to use, a little dry. But listen, it's hard to make bread, right, on Passover, right? It's hard to make imitation bread. What makes it so much better is the fact that it's McDonald's.
One upscale hotel in Jerusalem understood the purchasing power of American Jewish tourists on Passover. This year, they announced they'd concocted a recipe for kosher for Passover bagels. The chef told me he mixed water, matzah flour, oil, eggs, salt, and experimented with boiling the bagels until they came out the way he liked. I took a taste test.
It's good. It really is. You know, it doesn't taste like a normal bagel, but I think the cream cheese and the lox do the job.
Observant Jews aren't the only ones in Israel tickled by all the breadless and wheatless food this week. Passover's also a bonanza for Israelis with gluten allergies. One Israeli whose daughters have celiac disease said Israeli chocolate factories this time of year make kosher for Passover chocolate with no traces of gluten. So mom stocked up. She bought close to 100 chocolate bars. For The World, I'm Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem.
Even with potato starch, that yeast-free Big Mac bun looks pretty darn convincing. That's no matzah I've ever seen, that's for sure. Have a look for yourself at PRI.org. Coming up tomorrow, Kenya's elite runners are descending on Boston to compete in next Monday's marathon. Back home, they're in their own class.
They are seen as really the only professional sport in Kenya that makes some serious money. You know, people know them. It's the same way you would talk of, I think, Brady or something. He plays for the Patriots, something, yeah?
Tom Brady.
Yes, Tom Brady. Yeah.
That story tomorrow, right here on The World. You're listening to The World on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. More than 3 years into Syria's civil war, people are still pouring out of the country and into neighboring nations. In Turkey, the number of Syrian refugees is fast approaching 1 million. Only about a quarter of them are living in refugee camps. About 100,000 Syrians have made their way to Istanbul, where they do menial jobs, sell tea in parks, or work at restaurants, if they're lucky. For some, begging for money on the street is the only option. Dalia Mortada has more from Istanbul.
The Nişantaşı neighborhood's cobblestone streets are lined with brand names like Gucci, Chanel, and Prada. High-end restaurants are chock-full of the city's rich and famous. The sidewalks, where disheveled mothers sit with their babies and dirty barefoot children beg for handouts, are a different story. Fatma is Kurdish from northern Syria. Back in Aleppo, she and her husband both worked. They had a big house with a garden. Now in Istanbul, her family's just women and kids. Her husband's fighting alongside Kurdish rebels in Syria, and her eldest son is stuck in the Syrian army. She says neither she nor her daughter-in-law can find work, so they need to beg for the money to eat and pay rent. Complicating the lives of people like Fatma is the fact that Turks are now deeply suspicious of these beggars. She says people think they're Kurds from southern Turkey, pretending to be Syrians for sympathy. So she holds out her passport as she sits on the street. For a lot of Turks, the sight of Syrians begging, especially kids, is tough to stomach. But others are getting tired of being responsible for all the refugees. Engin is a store clerk in the neighborhood where Fatma begs. He says beggars are making as much as he does without lifting a finger. He says in a city this huge, there's no reason to beg. Anyone can find work doing just about anything. And if they can't work, Engin says, there are refugee camps that give them everything they need. He does seem to have a point. The camps here in Turkey have a reputation for being well-equipped, with grocery stores, kitchens, and even indoor plumbing. So it's hard to believe that hundreds of thousands of Syrians need to be on the streets. But the truth is, as the official refugee count nears 1 million in Turkey, the camps are nearly full with just a quarter of that number. And even if the refugee camps weren't full, many Syrians are afraid of them. When I approach a woman named Meryem to talk, she's frantic that our interview could lead to her going to a camp. She says she's heard awful things about what goes on in them. Meryem insists that the camps are full of suffering. Family members living there tell her that men are pressured to support opposition groups, and if they don't, they get beaten up. She also says there isn't freedom to move around. If you give me a house, shouldn't I also have the freedom to leave it, she asks. Whatever, we'll live like this, she declares, showing the one-room home she and her family of seven live in. We'll live on the streets. It's still better than the camps. Andrew Gardner with Amnesty International says it's really hard to tell what's going on in the Turkish refugee camps. The government won't give NGOs access, so rumors are rampant, and he's heard them all.
The other thing to recognize is that no one wants to live in a refugee camp. Everyone wants to, you know, to be able to move freely and to be able to, provide for themselves independently.
Even if that means living in tough conditions and begging to make ends meet. For The World, I'm Dalia Mortada in Istanbul.
Finally today, the Postal Service in Finland this week announced a new series of stamps. They will honor one of that nation's most famous artists, Tom of Finland. Now, in case you don't know his work, Tom of Finland's drawings were almost exclusively of muscular men busting out of their clothes. And it's those images that'll be featured on the new stamps. The World's Andrea Crossan has our story.
He was born Tuukko Laaksonen, but as an artist, he was known as Tom of Finland. He died in 1991. During his life, he sketched homoerotic images of young men with bulging muscles, mostly dressed in tight leather or not dressed at all. His style was always provocative. And like his friend Robert Mapplethorpe, Laaksonen's work had a huge influence on gay culture. He depicted men as soldiers, or bikers, lumberjacks, construction workers, throw in a cowboy and an Indian, and, well, you get it. Young man, there's no need to feel down, I said, young man. Tom of Finland's style influenced artists like the Village People and Freddie Mercury of Queen.
I don't think anybody since, you know, the Greco-Roman times really adulated and adored the human, the male form, like Tom did. He gave us godlike creatures, but they had a strong humanity to them. They were fantasy, but they were also our friends.
That's S.R. Sharp. He's one of the co-founders of the Tom of Finland Foundation. Sharp says that Laaksonen's work played a crucial role in changing the way gay men in the mid-20th century saw themselves.
We were very limited in our imagery before Tom of Finland. We were depicted as sissies or poofs or pansies or fairies, feminized, made lesser than. Tom sort of turned it around and made us more than.
The images the foundation chose for the stamps don't represent the most graphic of Tom of Finland's work, but one of the three designs shows a man's naked backside with a face peering between the legs. There are a number of countries around the world where a stamp with a man's buttocks on it would not be well received. For instance, Saudi Arabia or Nigeria, where homosexuality is illegal. And it's not unprecedented for a country to bar mail because of an offensive stamp. Ken Martin is with the American Philatelic Society.
The most famous, I think, was what was probably the first nude on a postage stamp. Spain in 1930 issued a series with a painting by Goya of a nude, which attracted a lot of attention. Best as I can determine, it appears the United States Postal Service actually rejected and returned mail bearing those stamps in the 1930s.
The Tom of Finland stamps are not the first to celebrate gay culture. In 2010, Austria issued a stamp celebrating the 15th anniversary of Vienna's Rainbow Parade. And next month, the U.S. Postal Service will issue a stamp with the image of American gay rights advocate Harvey Milk. As for Tom of Finland, his stamps will be released in September in conjunction with a retrospective exhibit of his life and work. For The World, I'm Andrea Crossan.
Don't stop me now.
You can see those sexy Tom of Finland stamps. It's Rainin Postman online. We have pictures at PRI.org. And that's our program today. Manan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH. I'm Marco Werman. We'll be with you again tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, by the National Endowment for the Arts, the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter Berge and Debbie Sitt, and Cindy and Howard Rachofsky. The WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can. By the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney-Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund.
PRI, Public Radio International.